The Tom Woods Show, episode 1173.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Homeschooling parents, it's going to be time to start thinking about next year before you know it. Let me recommend to you the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum, which I've been using with my daughters. It's going to preserve your mental health while it gives them a top-notch education. Plus, get $160 worth of free bonuses when you use my link, ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm all by myself today. I'm going to be reviewing the case of Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. This is the case of the Christian baker who wouldn't sell a cake to a same-sex couple. And we're going to talk about what the court's ruling was based on. And I'm going to talk about really every aspect of it, because I'm going to look at the justices who concurred in the decision but had additional arguments and points to raise. And I'm also going to talk about the dissenting judgment that we see here. Judge Ginsburg wrote a dissent, and I'm going to talk about that. But I want to go through point by point what the arguments are and then give maybe a bird's eye overview of how a libertarian ought to look at this, because there's a lot of specific argumentation relating to cakes versus wedding cakes specifically versus wedding cakes that have frosting on them with a message. And then, in fact, Justice Thomas, in his concurring opinion, has a lengthy passage on the historic significance of the wedding cake. And it just reminds you that if we just observed libertarianism, we could save ourselves a lot of this trouble going into the weeds of all the nitpicking significance of every little aspect of people's behavior. We could just have a few basic rules governing how we all interact with each other. Anyway, what I will do is link, for those of you who are curious, at tomwoods.com/1173 to the entire decision, including the not just the opinion of the court, but also the concurring statements and dissents as well. So that's something that you can study if this has holds any interest for you. But let's just start with the basics as they are laid out in the case itself of the circumstances. This case dates back to 2012 when a same-sex couple visited a bakery in Colorado called Masterpiece Cake Shop, and they wanted to get a cake for their wedding reception. The long and the short of it is, gay marriage was not recognized in Colorado at that time. So the plan was they were going to have their ceremony in Massachusetts and then come back to Colorado for a reception with friends and family. And the owner of Masterpiece Cake Shop, a fellow named Phillips, sat down with them and explained that he could not create this cake for them because he has a religious opposition to same-sex marriage. And therefore, what the couple wound up doing was filing a charge with the Colorado Civil Rights Commission alleging discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, and this violates the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act. So the commission, in turn, determined that the cake shop did indeed violate this Anti-Discrimination Act and ruled in favor of the couple. Then, in turn, the Colorado State Courts affirmed this ruling as well as the enforcement order. And now, in this case that I'm talking about today, the Supreme Court was deciding whether the commission's order violated the Constitution. So that's where we'll begin. This is the opinion of the court delivered by Justice Anthony Kennedy. All right, first of all, let's note that throughout the, well, at least in the decision for the court and then in Justice Thomas's concurring remarks, he says they make reference to the incorporation doctrine of the 14th Amendment. They don't use the words incorporation doctrine, but they say that the right of all persons to exercise fundamental freedoms under the First Amendment has been applied to the states through the 14th Amendment. Now, that's a little bit technical. I'm pretty sure I've discussed that on this program before, but the long and the short of it is, I think the evidence for that is pretty thin. I mean, given that the 14th Amendment is ratified in the 1860s, and yet we don't really get this view of its role until, well, at the earliest, I think the 1920s, strongly militates against this interpretation. The original idea is the one that you see in the case of Barron versus Baltimore from 1833. in which a unanimous court ruled that the Bill of Rights, as everybody knows, does not apply to the states. It is a restriction on the federal government only. And the states will have their own state constitutions, and they can have their own state bills of rights, but this is part of what it means to have a self-governing, decentralized republic, that not everything is enforced and carried out at the federal level, but we have rather a collection of independent societies that comprise the United States. That was a unanimous court. That was the only time John Marshall ruled against the federal government and in favor of the states, basically. Pretty much the only time. So it's significant that everyone just knew that's the way it was. Now, this relationship was supposedly altered by the 14th Amendment. The book on this is Government by Judiciary by the late Raoul Berger, who had been a professor at Harvard Law School. The short version of that book is called The 10th Amendment and the Bill of Rights. I believe that's what it's called. You can get the gist of his argument in about, 20% of the pages. So if you're in a hurry, I would read Berger in that format. Anyway, I don't want to dwell on the incorporation doctrine, but what's interesting is that so many people who support the incorporation doctrine and who say, well, this is how the federal government can come in and rescue people who are being oppressed by the states, you see how that swings both ways. Because this cause against the Christian Baker is considered to be a progressive cause, and yet here you have the federal government intervening and siding with the Baker. Now, if there hadn't been an incorporation doctrine, then the decision in Colorado would have stood with no further comment. And there would have been no grounds for the federal government in the form of the Supreme Court to intervene at all. So it goes to show that it's not so obvious that the incorporation doctrine will be used for so-called progressive purposes. But I have forsworn to discuss this aspect of the question because that will get us too far afield. Now, what we need to understand from the beginning, and which you may have read in some of the coverage and commentary on the case, is that the court is not making a decision based on the right of freedom of association. That is not really being raised, except in saying that in the past, for a long, long time, it's been presumed that when you have a business that caters to the public, like a retail store, or indeed a bakery, it is presumed that everybody comes into that store on an equal basis and that you will serve everybody on an equal basis. And this is a principle extending back into the common law and therefore is a principle that ought to be given great deference. So they're not going to consider that question. I'm going to consider that question after we go through this, but understand that they're not saying the baker's private property is the deciding factor. It's his property. He acquired it legitimately. It doesn't magically, like by some magic dust, turn into not fully his property just because he puts a sign on the door and says open for business. It's still his property. They're not arguing that. What they're arguing is that the state has an interest in balancing two competing claims here. On the one hand, the state wants to defend the free exercise of religion on the part of any person, including Phillips the baker. At the same time, the state has an interest in protecting certain groups, certain protected groups from discrimination, humiliation, etc. And so we have to bring these two concerns into balance. And what the court is going to decide is that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission did not observe the necessary balance here because the commission exhibited an anti-religious bias in the way they heard and responded to Phillips's case. The Supreme Court is going to say in the decision for the court by Anthony Kennedy that Phillips is entitled to a respectful treatment of his arguments, and he did not get that. So we're going to look at specific examples of what the court has in mind when it says he wasn't treated fairly by the commission in just a few minutes. We see this description of the balance that the government is trying to strike in this passage. In the decision, the court quotes from the Obergefell decision of 2015, that the famous gay marriage decision. They quote this statement: "The First Amendment ensures that religious organizations and persons are given proper protection as they seek to teach the principles that are so fulfilling and so central to their lives and faiths." And that is supposed to reassure us that certainly religious institutions will not be required to change their opinions on homosexuality. But, continues the current case, while those religious and philosophical objections are protected, it is a general rule that such objections do not allow business owners and other actors in the economy and in society to deny protected persons equal access to goods and services under a neutral and generally applicable public accommodations law. So how is the state going to decide between these two things? Well, it helps the Supreme Court that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission was so hostile to Phillips, because then they can say, well, look, they clearly weren't even remotely considering the legitimacy of his First Amendment case. Now, of course, again, the First Amendment strictly doesn't apply to the states if we ignore the incorporation, if we set aside the incorporation doctrine. But I'm not going to get into that point. The point is they're saying the Colorado Civil Rights Commission did not give due consideration to Phillips's position, and that pretty much ties our hands because they should have done that, and therefore we are going to side with Phillips, and that's where they're going to leave it. So I'm going to continue with the analysis of the case, but I'm just telling you, as you know, that's how they, that's the decision they made, and that's how they made the decision, that we have these two things to balance, the right of somebody to exercise his religion and the right of protected groups not to be subject to discrimination. Well, in this case, when the Colorado Civil Rights Commission tried to adjudicate the dispute, it was so clearly biased in one direction that it didn't give due consideration to one of the two sides. And so for that reason, we have to overrule what happened. That's their conclusion. Now, for this reason, my friend Kevin Gutzman, who co-authored the book Who Killed the Constitution with me in 2008, recently said in a radio interview, I think on the Lars Larson show, that this case reminds him of the Backe case from, I think, 1978, late 1970s anyway, involving the University of California system. Backe was a prospective medical student, and he was rejected for admission, even though he had grades that were much stronger than the grades of minority students who were accepted in his place. In fact, the Supreme Court conceded in a footnote, and now I'm quoting Gutzman, that the qualifications of the minority students were pitifully poor. Well, what the court wound up more or less saying in a very garbled decision was that the fact that the system had in place an outright quota system, well, that we could not accept. You can't have an outright quota system. However, you can admit somebody on the basis of race as long as race is, you know, just one of the factors under consideration. But what kind of a decision is that? Obviously, if it winds up being the deciding factor, then it may as well have been the only factor. So what the Backe case was in effect saying was, okay, if you want to have this kind of policy outcome, just don't be so obvious and open about it next time. You know, try to cloak it in 12 other considerations. Don't openly say it's a quota system. That's embarrassing to us. If you just couch it the right way, you'll get what you want. And that's what Kevin is saying is going on in this case. They're basically saying, if you want the outcome to go your way, just as long as you don't act like complete imbeciles like the people on the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, then you're going to be fine. So just avoid being openly moronic and belligerent, and chances are things are going to go your way. That's certainly the way I read this. Now, back to continuing with Anthony Kennedy's decision. He says that Phillips, the baker, argued that he had to use his artistic skills to make an expressive statement. And that's the thing here, that is what Phillips is doing expressive, because then it comes to be considered to be like speech. And Clarence Thomas, in what he has to say, Clarence Thomas says that there are many cases where the court has spoken of behaviors, of activities, as being effectively speech, like burning a flag or waving a flag or nude dancing or whatever. And they've said that that's more or less like speech. So if that's speech, then certainly, you know, giving a meaning to a cake would be expressive speech, would be the argument that Phillips is making, and indeed is the argument that Thomas himself makes, as we'll see. He says that clearly this is expressive. But anyway, here's Anthony Kennedy again. As he says, he argues, Phillips, that he had to use his artistic skills to make an expressive statement, a wedding endorsement in his own voice and of his own creation. As Phillips would see the case, this contention has a significant First Amendment speech component and implicates his deep and sincere religious beliefs. In this context, the baker likely found it difficult to find a line where the customer's rights to goods and services became a demand for him to exercise the right of his own personal expression for their message, a message he could not express in a way consistent with his religious beliefs. The court further observes that at that time, state law did afford storekeepers some latitude to decline to create specific messages that storekeepers considered offensive. And so the Civil Rights Division in Colorado itself had, on several other occasions, sided with bakers who had declined to create cakes. And those cakes had demeaned homosexual persons or marriages. And they had said, we're not doing that, and the Civil Rights Commission had upheld that decision by those bakers. Now, what exactly was it that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission did that gives the Supreme Court the impression that it was not neutrally evaluating the merits of Phillips's case? Well, here I'm reading from the court's decision. At several points during its meeting, commissioners endorsed the view that religious beliefs cannot legitimately be carried into the public sphere or commercial domain, implying that religious beliefs and persons are less than fully welcome in Colorado's business community. One commissioner suggested that Phillips can believe, quote, what he wants to believe, unquote, but cannot act on his religious beliefs, quote, if he decides to do business in the state, unquote. And then a few moments later, the commissioner restated this same position, saying, quote, if a businessman wants to do business in the state and he's got an issue with the laws impacting his personal belief system, he needs to look at being able to compromise, unquote. The court says that these statements standing alone don't prove discriminatory intent on the part of the Civil Rights Commission, but taken in tandem with what comes later, it strongly suggests that that is indeed what's happening. And so the commissioner said, I would also like to reiterate what we said in the hearing or the last meeting. Freedom of religion and religion has been used to justify all kinds of discrimination throughout history, whether it be slavery, whether it be the Holocaust, whether it be, I mean, we can list hundreds of situations where freedom of religion has been used to justify discrimination. And to me, it is one of the most despicable pieces of rhetoric that people can use to use their religion to hurt others. Now, that little outburst is going to be used very liberally by the court, because the court now says, to describe a man's faith as one of the most despicable pieces of rhetoric that people can use is to disparage his religion in at least two distinct ways, by describing it as despicable and also by characterizing it as merely rhetorical, something insubstantial and even insincere. The commissioner even went so far, and again, I'm still quoting from the court, as to compare Phillips's invocation of his sincerely held religious beliefs to defenses of slavery and the Holocaust. This sentiment is inappropriate for a commission charged with the solemn responsibility of fair and neutral enforcement of Colorado's anti-discrimination law, a law that protects discrimination on the basis of religion as well as sexual orientation. Then the court says that another way we can detect hostility on a religious basis against Phillips's case is the difference between how Phillips's case was treated and the cases of other bakers who objected to a requested cake on the basis of conscience and prevailed before the commission. Now, what's interesting is in the decision of the court drafted by Kennedy, you actually don't find out anything about these other cakes. You have to look at the Neil Gorsuch decision or concurring. When Gorsuch concurs, he writes about the nature of those cakes. But just so you know, those cakes apparently had like the pages of the Bible in them on them, and it was depicting that homosexual marriage had to be considered a sin, homosexuality was a sin. It was that sort of thing. And these bakers refused to bake those kinds of cakes. So it's very vague here exactly what kind of cake these other bakers were able to refuse. That's what they were refusing. And the Civil Rights Division of Colorado said that in each case, the requested cake included wording and images the baker deemed derogatory, or the baker deemed hateful, or deemed discriminatory. So the baker found fault with what was proposed to be depicted on these cakes and therefore refused to provide the cakes, and the commission upheld their decision to refuse to furnish those cakes. Now, if the commission, though, at the same time, is going to rule against Phillips on the grounds that any message that might appear on a wedding cake would be attributed to the customer, not to the baker, so he doesn't have to bear that burden, then why wouldn't that principle apply to these other cakes? Why would these other bakers who objected to these cakes on the grounds that they carried hateful or discriminatory messages, why couldn't they simply be told, well, bake that cake anyway, because any message on it will simply be attributed to the customer, not to you? And then moreover, there was further grounds for the Colorado Civil Rights Commission to exonerate these bakers. And that ground was these bakers made clear that they would sell other products to the prospective customers. But the point is, so would Phillips. Phillips already said that he would sell his customers anything else they wanted, just not this one thing. Well, likewise, these other bakers said, we'll sell you anything you want, just not these particular cakes. And the Colorado Civil Rights Commission said, you see, there's no discriminatory intent. They'll sell any other product to this person, just not this one. So that suffices to show that those bakers acted in good faith. But as soon as that principle is applied to, well, in Phillips' case, that principle's not applied. He was willing to sell his customers any other thing. But suddenly that principle drops out. So the Supreme Court is saying, you put all this together and it's obvious there's a double standard going on. And indeed, Phillips himself, before the Colorado Court of Appeals, said that this disparity in treatment showed hostility on the part of the commission toward his beliefs. And he said that the other baker's conscience-based objections were considered legitimate, but his were illegitimate. And that really what was happening was that the commission was sitting in judgment of his religious beliefs themselves. And now we really get to the heart of the court's argument, because it's going to say that the Colorado Court of Appeals, in upholding the Phillips decision, the decision that had been made against him by the Colorado Civil Rights Division, they're going to say, look, the division found that the bakeries, in the case of these other cakes, refused the patron's request because of the offensive nature of the requested message. And here's where the court is going to say, aha. So now, what, a state court is going to tell us what we're supposed to think is offensive? And now it's going to tell you what your religious views are supposed to translate into in terms of offense, what you're allowed to take offense at religiously and what you're not? That is not the competence of any court, and that is not what we are about. And that, therefore, clearly is an impairment of the free exercise of religion, and therefore the decision made against this baker must be set aside. Now, let me take a minute to read or go through the dissent that's joined in by Justice Sotomayor, by Justice Ginsburg. And Ginsburg is at pains to distinguish between the bakeries whose decisions were upheld, and the case of Phillips's bakery, where a decision was made against him because of his refusal to make a particular cake. She is saying, or the two of them are saying, that this couple was simply requesting a wedding cake, whereas the other fellow was going around to bakeries demanding offensive messages on cakes. But this was just a wedding cake, and it didn't necessarily involve any particular message or any statement of belief in heterosexual versus homosexual marriages in the abstract. It was just a cake. That was it. And the bakers visited by the other fellow would have sold him any baked goods they would have sold anyone else. But what they're saying is that Phillips would not sell to this gay couple for no reason other than their sexual orientation. This was a cake of the kind he regularly sold to others. Phillips, says Ginsburg, declined to make a cake he found offensive, where the offensiveness of the product was determined solely by the identity of the customer requesting it. The three other bakeries declined to make cakes where their objection to the product was due to the demeaning message the requested product would literally display. And now let me read where Justice Kagan is concurring with Justice Breyer joining. Again, I'm just going to point out the highlights in terms of what's distinguishing about these particular parts of the text. And then we'll get into Gorsuch and Clarence Thomas and then some overall considerations. So Kagan concurs with the decision, as does Justice Breyer, but they want to elaborate on a particular point. They accept the argument that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission did not satisfy the obligation of neutrality in the way it treated Phillips. But their argument is there was a way they could have gotten the decision that they obviously wanted without having had to compromise their neutrality. They say that the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act makes it unlawful for a place of public accommodation to deny the full and equal enjoyment of goods and services to individuals based on certain characteristics, including sexual orientation and creed. Well, the three Bakers in the so-called Jack cases did not violate that law. Jack requested them to make a cake, one denigrating gay people and same-sex marriage, that they would not have made for any customer. In refusing that request, the Bakers did not single out Jack because of his religion, but instead treated him in the same way they would have treated anyone else, just as the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act requires. By contrast, the same-sex couple in this case requested a wedding cake that Phillips would have made for an opposite-sex couple. In refusing that request, Phillips contravened the Act's demand that customers receive the full and equal enjoyment of public accommodations, irrespective of their sexual orientation. All right, I realize I'm throwing a lot at you. There's a lot here. And in a little while, I'm going to wrap it all up, bring it all together, and make some, offer some concluding thoughts about everything and what's significant about all this. But let's take a brief moment, catch our breath with this. And I am going to insert a message that I think you're going to enjoy and appreciate. The folks in my secret Facebook group are actually all very pleased about this particular promotion. And that is, given that Father's Day is coming up, and well, I'm a father, and I sure would enjoy getting this particular gift if anyone happens to be listening. And that is Omaha Steaks. I mean, your dad has all the neckties he needs, but he never has quite enough steaks, does he? And I'll tell you, our family has been eating Omaha Steaks for years and years and years. It's super convenient. You got tremendous variety and types of meat, high quality cuts. Well, in particular, they are promoting a deal that may be the best one I've ever seen. And that's what people in my private group are commenting on. They're saying that really is a tremendous price. So Omaha Steaks has a limited time offer right now for my listeners for Father's Day. At 78% off, this is really an amazing deal. So you go to omahasteaks.com, type Woods in the search bar, and you can get this Omaha Steaks Father's Day package, which includes two tender filet mignons, two beefy top sirloins, four chicken fried steaks, two boneless pork chops, four all-beef Omaha Steaks burgers, four gourmet jumbo franks, 12 ounces of all-beef meatballs, 1 pound of steakhouse fries, four caramel apple tartlets, one Omaha Steaks seasoning packet, and guess what? Get four more grill-ready Omaha Steaks burgers free with your purchase. And in fact, I just took a photo in my private group of me with the family. Well, actually, it was just a photo of the food, I'll be honest with you. We were about to prepare those burgers out on the grill outside, and man, that was fantastic. So again, get this limited-time package for only $49.99 for all that food. When you go to omahasteaks.com, type Woods in the search bar and add Father's Day package to your cart. This offer ends soon. So go to omahasteaks.com, type Woods in the search bar, grab your dad and fire up the grill. All right, let's get back to the case. Let's turn now to Justice Gorsuch with Justice Alito concurring. I actually think this is the most interesting set of arguments, even more so than Justice Thomas. And I'm by and large a fan of Justice Thomas. So what we read here is that the treatment of the three other Bakers shows that there is a clear double standard at work. And I'm interested in the way Gorsuch puts this. He says, the commission allowed three other Bakers to refuse a customer's request that would have required them to violate their secular commitments. That's an interesting way of putting it, that this isn't just some arbitrary situation, but rather they have secular commitments that they don't want to violate, and that right of conscience is upheld. So why wouldn't Phillips's right of conscience be upheld? So, you know, why was the same accommodation shown to Mr. Phillips when he refused a customer's request that would have required him to violate his religious beliefs? So there I'm quoting from Gorsuch. He says, as the court also explains, the only reason the commission seemed to supply for its discrimination was that it found Mr. Phillips's religious beliefs offensive. Well, that kind of judgmental dismissal of a sincerely held religious belief is, of course, antithetical to the First Amendment and cannot begin to satisfy strict scrutiny. The Constitution protects not just popular religious exercises from the condemnation of civil authorities, it protects them all. And so then he starts with William Jack's case. This is the guy who wanted the offensive cakes, right? So he says, he approached three bakers and asked them to prepare cakes with messages disapproving same-sex marriage on religious grounds. All three bakers refused Mr. Jack's request, stating that they found his request offensive to their secular convictions. And then he filed complaints because, you know, the Anti-Discrimination Act prohibits discrimination against customers in public accommodations because of religious creed, sexual orientation, or certain other traits. Mr. Jack argued that the cakes he sought reflected his religious beliefs and that the bakers could not refuse to make them just because they happened to disagree with his beliefs. But the division, again, I'm quoting from Gorsuch, declined to find a violation, reasoning that the bakers didn't deny Mr. Jack's service because of his religious faith, but because the cakes he sought were offensive to their own moral convictions. As proof, the division pointed to the fact that the bakers said they treated Mr. Jack as they would have anyone who requested a cake with similar messages, regardless of their religion. Gorsuch also notes in parentheses, almost certainly directed right at Justice Ginsburg, any suggestion that Mr. Phillips was willing to make a cake celebrating a same-sex marriage for a heterosexual customer, or was not willing to sell other products to a homosexual customer, then would simply mistake the undisputed factual record. And then again, let me continue quoting, the facts show that the two cases share all legally salient features. In both cases, the effect on the customer was the same. Bakers refused service to persons who bore a statutorily protected trait, religious faith, or sexual orientation. But in both cases, the bakers refused service intending only to honor a personal conviction. To be sure, the bakers knew their conduct promised the effect of leaving a customer in a protected class unserved. But there's no indication the bakers actually intended to refuse service because of a customer's protected characteristic. We know this because all of the bakers explained without contradiction that they would not sell the requested cakes to anyone, while they would sell other cakes to members of the protected class as well as to anyone else. So, for example, the bakers in the first case would have refused to sell a cake denigrating same-sex marriage to an atheist customer, just as the baker in the second case would have refused to sell a cake celebrating same-sex marriage to a heterosexual customer. And the bakers in the first case were generally happy to sell to people of faith, just as the baker in the second case was generally happy to sell to gay persons. In both cases, it was the kind of cake, not the kind of customer, that mattered to the bakers. The problem here, continuing from Gorsuch, is that the commission failed to act neutrally by applying a consistent legal rule. In Mr. Jack's case, the commission chose to distinguish carefully between intended and knowingly accepted effects. Even though the bakers knowingly denied service to someone in a protected class, the commission found no violation because the bakers only intended to distance themselves from, quote, the offensive nature of the requested message, unquote. Yet in Mr. Phillips's case, the commission dismissed this very same argument. It concluded that instead that an intent to disfavor a protected class of persons should be readily presumed from the knowing failure to serve someone who belongs to that class. In its judgment, Mr. Phillips's intentions were inextricably tied to the sexual orientation of the parties involved and essentially, quote, irrational. And now here's where Gorsuch really comes down on them. He says, nothing in the commission's opinion suggests any neutral principle to reconcile these holdings. If the Phillips objection is said to be inextricably tied to a protected class, then the baker's objection in Mr. Jack's case must be inexplicably tied to one as well. Because just as cakes celebrating same-sex marriage are, well, usually requested by people of a particular sexual orientation, so too are cakes expressing religious opposition to same-sex weddings, usually requested by persons of particular religious faiths. In both cases, the baker's objection would usually result in turning down customers who bear a protected characteristic. In the end, the commission's decision simply reduced to this. It presumed that Mr. Phillips harbored an intent to discriminate against a protected class in light of the foreseeable effects of his conduct, but it declined to presume the same intent in Mr. Jack's case, even though the effects of the baker's conduct were just as foreseeable. Underscoring the double standard, a state appellate court said that no such showing of actual animus or intent to discriminate against persons in a protected class was even required in Mr. Phillips's case. Well, says Gorsuch, the commission cannot have it both ways. The commission cannot slide up and down the mens rea scale, picking a mental state standard to suit its tastes depending on its sympathies. Either actual proof of intent to discriminate on the basis of membership in a protected class is required, as the commission held in Mr. Jack's case, or it is sufficient to presume such intent from the knowing failure to serve someone in a protected class, as the commission held in Mr. Phillips's case. Perhaps the commission could have chosen either course as an initial matter, but the one thing it can't do is apply a more generous legal test to secular objections than religious ones. So again, the commission cannot slide up and down the mens rea scale, picking a mental state standard to suit its tastes, depending on its sympathies. Moreover, he says, no bureaucratic judgment condemning a sincerely held religious belief as irrational or offensive will ever survive strict scrutiny under the First Amendment. In this country, the place of secular officials isn't to sit in judgment of religious beliefs, but only to protect their free exercise. So just as it is the proudest boast of our free speech jurisprudence that we protect speech that we hate, it must be the proudest boast of our free exercise jurisprudence that we protect religious beliefs that we find offensive. It's easy enough to defend popular religious views, but it's in protecting unpopular religious beliefs that we prove this country's commitment to serving as a refuge for religious freedom. And then Gorsuch directly addresses Ginsburg and Kagan when he says, it is no answer to observe that Mr. Jack requested a cake with text on it, while Mr. Craig and Mr. Mullen sought a cake celebrating their wedding without discussing its decoration, and then suggest this distinction makes all the difference. It is no answer either simply to slide up a level of generality to re-describe Mr. Phillips's case as involving only a wedding cake like any other. So the fact that Mr. Phillips would make one for some means he must make them for all. And he says, let's go through both of these. If we're going to suggest that cakes with words convey a message, but cakes without words do not, all in order to excuse the bakers in Mr. Jack's case while penalizing Mr. Phillips is irrational. Not even the commission or court of appeals purported to rely on that distinction. And he says, imagine Mr. Jack asked only for a cake with a symbolic expression against same-sex marriage rather than a cake bearing words conveying the same idea. Surely the commission would have approved the baker's intentional wish to avoid participating in that message too. Nor can anyone reasonably doubt that a wedding cake without words conveys a message. Words or not, and whatever the exact design, it celebrates a wedding. And if the wedding cake is made for a same-sex couple, it celebrates a same-sex wedding. Phillips wished to withhold his approval of this, but the commission denied Mr. Phillips that choice, even as it afforded the bakers in Mr. Jack's case the choice to refuse to advance a message they deemed offensive to their secular commitments. That is not neutral. And then he says, it would not be proper for this or any court to suggest that a person must be forced to write words rather than create a symbol before his religious faith is implicated. Again, civil authorities do not have it as their job to declare what is or should be orthodox when it comes to religious beliefs or any such question as that. It is our job to look beyond the formality of written words and afford legal protection to any sincere act of faith. And then he says, the second suggestion fares no better. If you're going to suggest that this case is only about wedding cakes, and not a wedding cake celebrating a same-sex wedding, this actually points up the problem. At its most general level, the cake at issue in Mr. Phillips's case was just a mixture of flour and eggs. At its most specific level, it was a cake celebrating the same-sex wedding of Mr. Craig and Mr. Mullins. But we are told here to apply a sort of Goldilocks rule. Describing the cake by its ingredients is too general. Understanding it as celebrating a same-sex wedding is too specific. But regarding it as a generic wedding cake is just right. But the problem is the commission didn't play with the level of generality in Mr. Jack's case in this way. It didn't say that because the cakes Mr. Jack requested were just cakes about weddings generally, and all such cakes are the same, so bakers have to produce them. Instead, the commission accepted the baker's position that these particular cakes being asked for by Mr. Jack were conveying a message offensive to their convictions, and therefore that allowed them to refuse service. Well, if they've done that there, it must do the same here in the case of Mr. Phillips. And then you see the real problem that develops here. Gorsuch says, why calibrate the level of generality in Mr. Phillips's case at wedding cakes exactly and not at, say, cakes more generally or cakes that convey a message regarding same-sex marriage more specifically? If cakes were the relevant level of generality, then the commission would have had to order the bakers to make Mr. Jack's requested cakes just as it ordered Mr. Phillips to make the requested cake in his case. Conversely, if the relevant level of generality were cakes that convey a message regarding same-sex marriage, well, the commission would have to respect Mr. Phillips's refusal to make that cake just as it respected the baker's refusal to make the cakes Mr. Jack requested. So when the same level of generality is applied to both cases, it's no surprise the bakers have to be treated the same. It's only when the dials are adjusted just right, fine-tuning the level of generality up or down for each case, based solely on the identity of the parties and the substance of their views, can you engineer the commission's outcome, handing a win to Mr. Jack's bakers, but delivering a loss to Mr. Phillips? Such results-driven reasoning is improper. Neither the commission nor this court may apply a more specific level of generality in Mr. Jack's case, a cake that conveys a message regarding same-sex marriage, while applying a higher level of generality in Mr. Phillips's case, a cake that conveys no message regarding same-sex marriage. The government must apply the same level of generality across cases, and that did not happen here. Then finally, we get to Justice Thomas, with whom Justice Gorsuch joined, concurring in part and concurring in the judgment. And in this statement, Justice Thomas does not say anything about the commissioners and their discriminatory remarks. He says, that's certainly disturbing, but the discriminatory application of Colorado's public accommodations law is enough on its own to violate Phillips's rights. And to the extent that the court is pointing that out, then I concur. So then this is where Thomas is going to talk about conduct being expressive. And once a court concludes that conduct is expressive, it has held that the Constitution limits the government's authority to restrict or compel it because it's thought of as being, in effect, an extension of free speech. And he says, Thomas, that Phillips's conduct in creating and designing custom wedding cakes is expressive. He says Phillips considers himself an artist. If you look at the logo for his masterpiece cake shop, what do you see there? An artist's paint palette with a paintbrush and a baker's whisk. And then behind the counter, he has a picture depicting him as an artist painting on a canvas. He takes exceptional care with each cake that he creates. He sketches out the design on paper, chooses a color scheme, creates the frosting and decorations, bakes and sculpts it, decorates it, delivers it. He is an active participant in the wedding celebration itself. He discusses the people's preferences and personalities, and he makes sure that each cake reflects the couple who ordered it. So in other words, this is clear evidence that this is expressive. Then, moreover, wedding cakes in general do communicate a message that a wedding has occurred, a marriage has begun, and the couple should be celebrated. And so Thomas actually goes into some history of the wedding cake and what it represents. So, I mean, can you believe that we're reduced to this? We have to go into the history of the wedding cake at this point to decide how we are to interact with each other and when we're allowed to use violence against each other. So anyway, he concludes that Phillips's creation of custom wedding cakes is expressive, and he's using his artistic talents to create a well-recognized symbol that celebrates the beginning of a marriage and that clearly communicates a message, certainly more so than nude dancing, he says, which the court has also upheld. So he says, by forcing Phillips to create custom wedding cakes for same-sex weddings, Colorado's public accommodations law alters the expressive content of his message. The Colorado Court of Appeals, says Thomas, had been wrong to conclude that Phillips's conduct was not expressive on the grounds that any reasonable observer seeing him produce these cakes would just think he's just complying with Colorado's public accommodations law. They wouldn't attribute the message on the cake to him. But as Thomas says, this argument would justify any law that compelled protected speech, and this course has never accepted it. For example, when there was a St. Patrick's Day parade and there was a homosexual group that wanted to be part of it, and the court had said that the application of Massachusetts public accommodations law does not require this parade to alter the expressive content of their parade. It did not hold that, well, you have to let anybody march, and everybody will just know that, well, you're just complying with public accommodations law. No, they didn't say that. They did not hold that reasonable observers will just view the organizers as complying with Massachusetts public accommodations law. They did not hold that. And so we should be consistent. Thomas also has a section on whether the fact that he's running a for-profit bakery has anything to do with the question. He doesn't think it does, and I'm going to skip over that. I don't think that's super important. Then he says that, again, if he just posts a disclaimer, maybe he could post a disclaimer saying that we don't support same-sex marriage. He'll still have to make the cakes, but he could express his, you know, what his conscience is compelling him to say with a placard on the wall or something. But as Thomas says, again, this argument would justify any law compelling speech. And again, this court has rejected it. And he goes on and cites precedents. He then says that according to the individual respondents, Colorado can compel Phillips's speech to prevent him from denigrating the dignity of same-sex couples, asserting their inferiority, and subjecting them to humiliation, frustration, and embarrassment. But Thomas says states can't punish protected speech because some group finds it offensive, hurtful, stigmatic, unreasonable, or undignified. And then he cites another case as saying, if there is a bedrock principle underlying the First Amendment, it is that the government may not prohibit the expression of an idea simply because society finds the idea itself offensive or disagreeable. Again, a contrary rule would allow the government to stamp out virtually any speech at will. Because after all, much political and religious speech might be perceived as offensive to someone. And in fact, he cites yet another decision as saying, indeed, if it is the speaker's opinion that gives offense, that consequence is a reason for according it constitutional protection. And then Thomas reminds us to recall what Phillips actually said to the couple. I'll make your birthday cake, shower cake, sell you cookies and brownies. I just don't make cakes for same-sex weddings. Well, he says it's hard to see how this statement stigmatizes gays and lesbians more than blocking them from marching in a city parade, dismissing them from the Boy Scouts, or subjecting them to signs that say God hates fags, all of which this court has deemed protected by the First Amendment. And he cites all that. He says, moreover, it's also hard to see how Phillips' statement is worse than the racist, demeaning, and even threatening speech toward blacks that this court has tolerated in previous decisions. Concerns about dignity and stigma did not carry the day when this court affirmed the right of white supremacists to burn a 25-foot cross, and he's citing a 2003 decision there, or conduct a rally on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, citing a 1992 case, and so on. Thomas cites the Obergefell decision itself, which said that the traditional understanding of marriage, quote, long has been held and continues to be held in good faith by reasonable and sincere people here and throughout the world, unquote. And he says, if Phillips's continued adherence to that understanding makes him a minority after Obergefell, that is all the more reason to insist that his speech be protected. And then I'll read you the concluding paragraph of Thomas. In Obergefell, I warned that the court's decision would, quote, inevitably come into conflict, unquote, with religious liberty, quote, as individuals are confronted with demands to participate in and endorse civil marriages between same-sex couples, unquote. This case proves that the conflict has already emerged. Because the court's decision vindicates Phillips's right to free exercise, it seems that religious liberty has lived to fight another day. But in future cases, the freedom of speech could be essential to preventing Obergefell from being used to, quote, stamp out every vestige of dissent, unquote, and, quote, vilify Americans who are unwilling to assent to the new orthodoxy, unquote. If that freedom is to maintain its vitality, reasoning like the Colorado Court of Appeals must be rejected. All right, that's a lot right there. But I think it's worth going through it because it shows you what's at stake and what's not at stake. This thing wound up, I mean, you see how unbelievably nitpicky it is about cakes and the meaning of cakes and a cake without a message and a cake with a message, but doesn't the cake in itself convey a message? And what if I want an offensive cake? But wait a minute, am I allowed to say that this cake celebrating this wedding is offensive? Or is it just, am I allowed to be offended only by things that the Colorado Court of Appeals think I should be offended by? And is it up to the state to define what's offensive and what I'm allowed to not decorate or sell or bake? Or it's insane. You see, this is where you wind up when you abandon the idea of simple freedom of association, you wind up with these interminable arguments about different bakers and different cakes and messages and meanings and faith and all that. I mean, if you want to navigate this minefield, then be my guest. But I think it'd be much simpler to say, how about we just have an opinion that if somebody doesn't want to bake me a cake, I go to another baker. Instead of saying, I'm going to devote myself to destroying this person. Let me be honest with you. It is to some degree easy for me to say that, isn't it? Because chances are, if I went in and ordered a cake from somebody, there'd be no problem. They would just give it to me. So honestly, I don't know what it's like to have somebody turn down your cake order. But yet at the same time, I don't feel like this is the world's worst example of oppression either. And I just can't imagine that my response would be, I'm going to spend the rest of my life basically waging a war on this person, which is certainly going to destroy him, or at least my goal is to destroy him. That's not the society I want to live in. I don't even want that to be an option. Somebody doesn't want to do business with me, therefore, because I'm God's gift to mankind, you don't want to do business with me, therefore you don't deserve to exist. Or you have a different opinion from me, your moral views are different from mine, therefore you don't deserve to exist. I don't want to live in that society. I'd much rather say, well, okay, you don't want to do business with me, I'll find somebody who does. And in this day and age, for heaven's sake, I mean, I realize there are people on the other side who think that we're on the verge of segregation being reintroduced and the Ku Klux Klan is making a comeback or something. I mean, these are people who constantly refer to the Ku Klux Klan like it even matters in this day and age, like it has more than 3,000 members. So I realize there are some people who feel like that white people are just waiting for the opportunity to deny black people service or something. You would be driven out of business in 5 seconds thanks to social media. The main concern really is not so much that I want to be able to refuse service to arbitrary categories of people, but rather that, let's say there are shoplifters in my store or people who are disruptive in my hotel. I just want to throw out the shoplifters and the disruptive people. Well, what if it turns out that I'm not throwing out disruptive people in precisely the right percentage in terms of their representation in the population? Look, I want people's money. I don't care who they are. I want people's money. So probably I'm not going to just arbitrarily throw people out. But what if the Justice Department came in and demanded to see the percentage breakdown of the people I threw out of my hotel? You know, maybe I haven't thrown out enough Chinese Americans from my hotel to satisfy them. That's the problem. It's not so much that I really, really want to exclude X and Y. I don't want to exclude anybody from my hotel. I just want to make sure that my decisions to exclude certain people who might be troublemakers aren't second-guessed, and I'm not lectured to that I'm secretly trying to oppress an entire group when I'm not. I'm innocently trying to protect my business. So again, what I said in the middle of the episode or toward the beginning of the episode, in the long run with this case, what it's basically saying is, if you want to screw over a Christian baker, just don't be openly and in a low IQ way anti-religion when you do it, because then you probably get what you want. So I'm not convinced that this is any big victory. And again, this idea, we've got to balance your right to your religion with our interest in keeping people from being discriminated against. I don't know how you do that. That sounds really complicated. Simply saying, why don't we just let people who want to interact with each other interact with each other? That seems like a simple principle we can all agree on. And if people don't want to interact with you or with some group, why is that actually a problem? If they don't want to interact with you, why would you want to interact with them? Why would you want to give your money to somebody who hates you so much he'd rather be poor than interact with you? Why are you chomping at the bit to have a chance to interact with that person? Wouldn't it be better for that person to be totally open about where he stands so you can tell the world about it? Not to mention, it gets rid of all these problems of interminable cases about cakes and the difference between an undecorated and a decorated cake and what. How about, do you want to have this interaction? Then go ahead and have it. If one of you doesn't want to have it, then why should one party be compelled to do something he doesn't want to do? How about just that principle? Even if he's a jerk. So what is your general principle? Jerks need to be compelled to do things I think they ought to do, but it's their stuff. Like they own the flower and they own the store and they work to build the thing. It's their thing. They want to do something with it that you don't like. Well, okay, get your own bakery. But it's like people who think that the oil companies ought to be charging less. Says who? How do you know what the price of oil ought to be? Are any of you actually going to the trouble to to build an oil refinery or to go to the trouble to build an oil well or something. None of you are going to the trouble, but you're going to sit here and second guess the decisions of other people. Also, I think the way the decision is made, it just leaves the impression that, of course, we all know that religious people are irrational, but we need to protect them in their right to be as dumb and backward as they want to be. That's the impression I get reading this case. We all know these things are not subject to the scrutiny of reason. We all know they're completely arbitrary and stupid, but people have the right, the solemn right enshrined in our Constitution, to be arbitrary and stupid. That's what comes through here. And I know there are people who listen to the show who think that way about religious people. They're just arbitrary and stupid. They believe in an invisible being for stupid reasons. And they might as well worship the flying spaghetti monster because there's just as much evidence for that. And I've covered this. I have an episode 272 on believing in God. And I'll just say this, and I know this is going to annoy some people who listen, but I can't just do the show where all I do is say what I think everybody wants and then just do lowest common denominator. You wouldn't want that, right? You wouldn't want me to do that, so I'm not going to do that. But if you're going around spreading this flying spaghetti monster thing, you're an idiot, okay? You are completely unfamiliar with any of the arguments or the major thinkers in the Western intellectual tradition, period. Now, you can disagree with them. You can think their arguments are unpersuasive, but there is no way you can posit this flying spaghetti monster thing and say, ah, ha, ha, I'm just showing how stupid religious people are because they might as well believe in the flying spaghetti monster. That's dumb. That's dumb, and that's beneath you. Okay, you sound like Paul Krugman talking about Austrian business cycle theory. Since most people on the internet also don't know Austrian business cycle theory, they walk away thinking Paul Krugman really demolished them and he's really smart. Likewise, almost nobody on the internet knows any of Thomas Aquinas' arguments. And if they do know them only in caricature. So they hear your flying spaghetti monster stuff and they walk away thinking, boy, that guy's really sharp. But for people who are smart, think of how we look at Krugman when he talks about the Austrian theory of the business cycle. We think this guy's hopeless. Well, that's how I feel when I see you talking about the flying spaghetti monster. I think, oh, here's another guy who thinks he's super educated and he's an idiot. Sorry, you're an idiot. I'm just going to say it. Now, of course, I am not saying all atheists are idiots. I know very smart atheists. That is not what I'm saying. I'm talking about loudmouth people who talk about things they've never studied. That is not an admirable trait. If you really want to know, by the way, what the arguments for the existence of God are. They're not arguments based on, they're not a posteriori arguments that have to do with, well, you know, there's some stuff we can't explain, and so that must be God. That's not really what these classical arguments are all about. And it's not that, well, you know, everything has a cause, and so there must be an uncaused. I mean, it's not that. Everything has a cause is not part of any classical argument for the existence of God. Okay, that is not most of what a lot of people think. Anyway, you should read Edward Faser's book, Five Proofs for the Existence of God. Just came out not too long ago. Faser is spelled F-E-S-E-R. This is extremely high-level stuff. And I think if you're going to talk about this sort of thing, you need to know what you're talking about. You need to be familiar with the other side. Because the other side is not saying, we just want to take an arbitrary, irrational position for no good reason other than we're stubborn and we enjoy being stubborn. Because if that's what you think the other side is, or we don't quite understand where thunder comes from, so we're just going to say God must have created it, then you don't understand the argument you're having. Okay, and it's really frustrating for people on our side because we can't even begin to discuss it with you because you don't even know what the arguments are. So please don't just, you know, whatever you want to say about religion, and I know a lot of people don't like it, at least come at it from an informed position. And a really great way to do that is to read the Ed Faser book. Now, if I sound annoyed here, that's because I am. Because I guess after a while, I get tired of being treated like I'm some imbecile, or I'm backward and stupid, or I'm not enlightened enough, or don't I understand that I shouldn't be worried about invisible beings in the sky. The idea that I'm supposed to be made to feel stupid by that level of argument, when that's a really, really dumb thing to say and shows no familiarity with anything, that's annoying. You know, it's kind of like when Michael Malice is on Twitter and he's trolling people by saying things like, he'll get the date of the creation of the Berlin Wall wrong and the purpose of it or whatever. And we all know he's trolling. We all know he obviously knows the whole history of the Berlin Wall. And people are solemnly trying to correct him. And Michael does not like you to come in and tell them he's just trolling you. But I can't help it. I want to come in and tell them because I don't want people to think that they're smarter than Michael Malice. I need them to know he's smashing them. And this is kind of how I feel like when I'm, you know, the way I see Christians and Catholics in particular treated this way by people who don't know that much, let's say, who think, oh, I just showed them. I'm going, oh my gosh, this is making me crazy. So at least either don't talk about it or at least read a couple of books first and then talk about it. It's just the way Paul Krugman should treat Austrian business cycle theory. So that, I think, is another unfortunate aspect of the way this case is argued. But they have to argue it this way. Because we're not even considering freedom of association, the only way a baker could be exonerated here is with some, well, all right, maybe you're exercising your religion. And we know the Constitution allows you to do that. So we'll try and save you. We'll throw you a lifeline with that. But if we could just say, well, it's your property, and you decide which cakes get baked, that would just solve the whole thing. And yeah, it wouldn't satisfy people who want to stamp out all dissent and make everybody exactly identical and force everybody to think the same way. Those people wouldn't be satisfied, but those people shouldn't be satisfied. Those people should stew for a while the rest of us just interact with each other on a decent one-on-one basis. And we 99% of the time, we all want to interact with each other, 99% of the time. Every once in a while, we might have some reason where we say, you know what, I just don't want this transaction to go through. And, you know, that's the price you pay for living in a society based on peace. Peace and mutual respect. I'm not going to force you to do something you don't want to do. And I am certainly, over my dead body, am I going to go fetch the state's goons to force you to do something you don't want to do. Because that's despicable and loathsome. And on that note, I am going to end things for today. If you'd like to debate and discuss this, then come join me in the private group that you can access through supportinglisteners.com. And thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.